program, Tom Hartman. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Finally, back home in Portland, Oregon, at our home station, AM 620 KPOJ, but broadcasting live from Los Angeles to New York and all places in between, and streaming around the world as well over at AirAmerica.com. It is the election season, as you probably have noticed, and the Republicans are out there, and already we're hearing about the push polls and the dirty tricks being done by one Republican against the other, oddly enough. Gee, what a surprise. As happened to George W. Bush, well, actually, as happened to John McCain, apparently from the Bush campaign in the year 2000, these emails flying around, push polls about Mitt Romney and Mormonism, picking up in numbers and reports on these kinds of things, causing some consternation among Republican circles. Alan Raymond would know. Alan Raymond helped rig an election in the state of New Hampshire, the one that got John Sununu elected. He's up for re-election now. He was up against Gene Shaheen, the very popular Democratic governor of that state, and won by a whisker. And some would say that Alan Raymond played a role in that victory. Alan Raymond, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. You have a new book out. It's called How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. How did you guys rig the election?
Well, the case that you just referred to, and in the book there are a number of stories, but the case you're referring to is what's commonly known as the New Hampshire phone jamming scandal, and it was pretty much an adolescent thing in and of itself. It was simply calling up the Democratic operation on election day in Manchester, New Hampshire, and tying up the phone line so they couldn't make any calls or couldn't receive any calls coming in, which was, designed, like everything is on election day, to get out the vote. So we jammed those phone lines, and consequently, I paid a very heavy price for such a dirty trick.
Yeah, you went to prison as a consequence of this.
I was incarcerated for 3 months. That's correct.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, I heard a comment, or I read a comment, that you had said that having worked with Republicans all these years, being with some good, honest criminals wasn't so bad.
Yeah, that's right. But more importantly, I had some time to reflect, and I had some time to really think about the consequences of the things that I used to do in politics to win, because, I never approached it, and it doesn't get approached, and maybe it even shouldn't be approached. From a moral perspective, guys like me are hired to win. The stuff that's in the book is salacious, but it's not salacious for the sake of itself. It's salacious to teach the reader how to look for this stuff. So they ask themselves, why me? Why am I getting a certain political message? What do they think I'm going to do with that message?
Well, this is already happening. I mean, I'm talking about on my radio program yesterday how the day before yesterday, as I was traveling through an airport, I was sitting at the bar watching CNN. And the guy next to me, just, average Joe, starts telling me how Barack Obama is a secretly part of a Muslim campaign to take over America and turn it over to Al-Qaeda. That, as part of this incredible viral email that has just gone ballistic, and conflating Barack Obama with Keith Ellison, saying that, he had his hand on the Quran when he was sworn in. Well, actually, none of these guys use a Bible to get sworn in. The swearing in is a civil ceremony. The photo op afterwards is where usually you use the Bible. But nonetheless, Barack Obama used a Bible to get sworn in. He is a Christian. But that's not already the stuff on the left is happening. Already the stuff on the right is happening. I've gotten emails about weird vagaries of the Mormon Church and how Mitt Romney is going to try to change America and reinstitute polygamy and things. I mean, the guys who are doing the kind of stuff that you were a part of are out there. They're still out there. What do we do about it?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, what you just said is true, and neither party is true blue on this stuff. They're both guilty of infractions here, and the stuff that you're talking about, particularly with Senator Obama, is, that's pretty tough. I mean, you might as well, glue a beard to his face and call him Saddam when you make those types of accusations.
Or Osama, and I guarantee that if he's the nominee, the Republicans certainly will, and right now there may be some Democrats who are.
Yeah, but you know, the answer to your question is, what do you do about it? And really, it's kind of eternal vigilance, and that's why I wrote the book. There's a famous quote of, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is a little bit of sunlight on the creepier corners of American politics, so the reader can really take a look and understand for themselves what's going on. Because, look, we're all busy. We have, you know, voters have, they're out there doing stuff, raising their kids, going to work, and they don't have a lot of time to spend on it, and it's tough. And guys like me are counting on that, because it enables us to get in there with messages and essentially tap into voter predisposition and get you to do things because of, you know, how the message is being framed.
We're talking with Alan Raymond. He's the author of How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. And, Alan, your employer made multiple phone calls to the White House. We don't know if it was directly to Karl Rove's office or to George W. Bush or Dick Cheney or who it might have been, but he made a series of phone calls to the White House before this was done. You talk in your book about how you actually consulted an attorney about whether or not this was legal, and the attorney wouldn't give you an answer in writing. But I'm curious, A, how do you feel about the probability that people way above you were actually calling the shots and making the decisions, and their names aren't even being mentioned? And B, to what extent, how high do you think this goes in the Republican Party? This not just condoning, but encouraging openly, not just immoral, but criminal acts.
Well, I'll tell you, I used to work at the RNC, which I detail in my book. And just so your listeners understand, you know, the book is not all medicine. It's medicine, but it has a mint julep taste. I mean, I hope when you read it, you laughed out loud, because I'm trying to entertain. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm trying to lead you down a path to kind of open your eyes a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stories in the book. It's largely autobiographical. I should let our listeners know. It kind of tells the arc of your political life, but other parts of your life as well.
Yeah, and I had a lot of interesting experiences. But to answer your question, I used to work at the RNC, and there's two things that I know. And one is, when I was an agent for the RNC as a regional political director, no program ever saw the light of day, particularly one so unusual as this was, unless it had been vetted. So I had faith in the fact that, you know, this is not an organization of rogues. These are highly trained professionals.
In other words, you didn't expect to go to prison when you took on this job.
Yeah, certainly not. That was never in the cards in my life. So, I know people sometimes think it should have been a harsher sentence, but one of the things I learned is our sentencing guidelines and the country sends way too many people to prison, but maybe that's that's another discussion. But, so there's two things that I knew when I got the call from the agent of the RNC in New England, which was it had to have been vetted, because something so unusual doesn't see the light of day unless it has been. And the RNC never cares about who the vendor is unless they're paying the bill. And so that's why it wasn't something that I would have easily dismissed.
Because the RNC was paying your bill.
Well, ultimately it was the New Hampshire Republican State Committee who was the client.
Right.
But when I worked at the RNC, I never cared about who the vendor was who got the work unless I, as the agent of the RNC, was making sure it was getting funded.
Yeah. So is that a soft way of saying that you think that there was complicity at the highest levels in these criminal acts? That would be, for example, Karl Rove or George Bush?
Well, I'm going to be more fair than they were to me because, you know, as I say in the book, you know, not only did they throw me under the bus, but they checked my pockets before they did to make sure to see if there was any money there, and then they blamed me for getting run over.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be more fair than they were to me, and I'll say I've never seen any evidence of it going to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't. So I fairness to everybody, that's what I have to tell you.
In your book, go ahead.
Well, but I mean, the White House is in de facto control of the Republican National Committee when a Republican president is in the Oval Office. So, you know, there are lines of responsibility here that can't be ignored.
Yeah. You talk about the Southern Strategy in your book, and you just make it very clear. The Southern Strategy was a grab by the Republican Party for the racist vote in the South.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm what's known as a moderate Republican. I'm from New Jersey. That's where I ran most of my experience is. And so, the Southern Strategy, the Republicans from the South didn't have much interest in Republicans from Mid-Atlantic or moderate Republicans, because we just weren't what they were all about.
And you wanted to pick up those Democrats who were disenchanted with LBJ because he signed the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, look, American politics is still highly charged with race issues, with bigotry, and, you know, these things do get used in campaigns to trigger reactions, and that's what, one, that's why Senator Obama's candidacy is so tremendous.
Yeah, we're talking with Alan Raymond, his book, How to Rig an Election. Alan, can you stick around for just a few minutes with us?
Yeah, sure thing.
Great, I'd appreciate it, because I have a couple more questions that I'd like to get in here. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Stand beside that deal, stand and fight. I do believe there's a dream for everyone. This is our country.
This is our country, my friends, and let's take it back and let's put things on a more positive tone. Wouldn't that be a fine thing? 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The real mainstream. And we're talking with Alan Raymond. He's the author of a new book, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. He was a highly placed operative, former top GOP operative who served federal prison time for the phone jamming operation in the 2002 New Hampshire election, federal election, that led to the election of John Sununu over Gene Shaheen. And there's going to be a rematch in that race coming up in November. And that's going to be a real interesting one to watch. Alan, at the very end of your book, in fact, the way you end the book, essentially, is by saying, that's everything I can tell you from the inside, how the system's used by people just like me in both parties and how they're paid to win at all costs. Tactics will only get tougher, nastier, more brutal, because the tricks of the trade are known, embellished upon, and passed forward by people like me to more people like me, with the competition growing stiffer and the stakes rising higher with every election. So there it is. And then your last sentence, now what are you going to do about it? You're laying down a challenge to us, to we the people, the voters, and people inside and outside the political system. Two quick questions in the 3 or 4 minutes here we'll have in this segment. One, what do you expect to see? What are the tactics that have been played out in the past and have been successfully used in the past that you expect to see and see more of? And number two, what should we do about it? What can we do about it?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of these types of tactics in both primaries coming up, and you mentioned some, and I won't get into them, but, you know.
Well, feel free. I mean, your book has some marvelous stories, and I'd love you to tell a couple of them on the air if you can do it very briefly.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that you'll see, for instance, the use of, and this happens a lot, the use of accented voices into households that are geared to trigger a reaction.
So yeah, you pointed out in the book, for example, having a, quote, ghetto voice call people and on behalf, supposedly on behalf of a candidate when it's actually opposing that candidate, or people calling with a Hispanic voice and saying, you know, we need to give amnesty to all the Hispanics and therefore vote for Joe Blow, and when in fact what you're trying to do is destroy Joe Blow.
Yeah, that's right. So say if you have a Democratic household and you call them with an immigration message using a Latin or Hispanic accent, you're getting past the message and you're getting towards more, you know, using race as a motive to energize that vote. So you're going to see more of these things. You know, for instance, the things about polygamy and Mitt Romney you're starting to see in South Carolina already. The South Carolina primary is going to be tough, but you know, the thing to really look for is going to be the what's called the 527 and the C4 committees that will be set up. And the most well-known with your listeners is probably the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. You're going to see lots of those proliferate. And those are the things to keep an eye on, because that's where, you know, the messages are used in such a way, And the candidates have total plausible deniability.
Right, there's a level of insulation there.
That's right. Yeah. So now the challenge is, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
And, you know, for instance, you having this dialogue with your listeners, the New York Times having an op-ed about, you know, reforms that are needed, sunlight, basically, paying attention and being educated as to how the process works is going to relieve your listeners from all the burdens of getting all these political messages so they can actually go out and make the decision based on fact, not on emotion, because that's what campaigns are.
Sometimes these candidates are stuck in a tough place. I mean, how does Mitt Romney He's getting the attacks right now in South Carolina that are not that dissimilar from what John McCain got. And you write about that in your book as well in the 2000 election where oddly enough, Romney's hired the same PR company that has been tied to those calls where they were calling registered Republicans and saying, if you knew that McCain had an African-American child out of wedlock, would you still vote for him when he had an adopted daughter from Bangladesh who had dark skin? And it wiped him out in the 2000 election. It allowed George Bush to win. That same PR firm that seems to have been associated with them, according to Bill Moyers, the show that I saw, or now with David Brancaccia, is one or the other, is under the employ of Mitt Romney. I mean, what? How do you respond to that kind of thing without giving it more legs? I mean, this is what I think John Kerry was afraid of, is that if he responded to swift boats, he'd give them more publicity.
Right, but you know what? Presidential campaigns particularly are about authenticity. I think you're seeing it with Governor Romney right now. I think people are assessing that he's just not an authentic candidate. So that's if you're a candidate, that's how you really need to respond. You can't let these types of things go unresponded to. You just can't let someone have a free run on defining who you are, because campaigns are basically a message box. It's what you say about yourself and what you say about your opponent and vice versa from your opponent's perspective.
So should Barack Obama be out there right now saying, hey, I know that there's this email going around like crazy that says that I didn't raise my hand for the Pledge of Allegiance and that it's a lie, or that I was sworn in on the Quran and it's a lie? Should he come right out and say that?
Well, you know, he doesn't have to come out right and say that, because he doesn't necessarily want to take it head on such as that, but he can do it in other ways. And the way that Barack Obama is doing is very – I was up in New Hampshire, and I wanted to go get a taste of that magic and couldn't get into the event because it was so crowded. And that's just by his lifting rhetoric. I mean, you know, but that is the challenge, and that is how we make our choices. Can our president pass that test? Because those are rough tests, but, you know, the American people want someone who can endure.
You're absolutely right. Alan Raymond, his book, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. Alan, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Good luck. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Fire it up, fire it up. We push off, we're rolling boulders, crash down the mirror stairways.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's getting strange out there on the internet, you know. It's getting very strange. Why did the chicken cross the road? Thanks to Richard Russell for this. I'm not sure if he's the author of it or not, or if it's just one of those things that's going around the tubes, not the trucks. But here are the political answers. Why did the chicken cross the road? 2008 edition. Hillary Clinton. I have vast experience with chickens, and if elected, I will ensure that every chicken has the ability to cross any road it desires. Why did the chicken cross the road? Barack Obama. It was time for change. John Edwards. To escape exploitation. Bill Richardson. It had lots of different kinds of experience on its own side of the road and was ready for a new and bigger challenge. Dennis Kucinich. I'm not sure. Let me pull out my Constitution and see what it says about chickens. Mike Gravel. It was the war. It makes everybody do crazy things. Speaking of crazy... Why did the chicken cross the road? Republican versions. Ron Paul. Higher prices for eggs on the other side. It's the invisible hand of the free market. Mitt Romney. The chicken has always been on that side of the road. Mike Huckabee. What? The chicken crossed the road? There's no way that could happen in nature. It must be a miracle. Praise Jesus. John McCain. Well, if you've never been in captivity yourself, you can't possibly imagine what you'd do to get away. Tom Tancredo. It was a Mexican chicken. It was looking for your job and your daughter. Rudy Giuliani. Why did the chicken cross the road? 2008 edition. Rudy Giuliani. 9/11. Tommy Thompson. What? Fred Thompson. George W. Bush. It was a road crossing chicken. In other words, it was the kind of chicken who liked to cross the road. And Dick Cheney. That's, oops, sorry. Yeah. So, why did the chicken cross the road? Modern edition. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free nationwide, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Our blog over at TomHartman.com and message board as well, plus over at AirAmerica.com. Carl in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Carl, welcome to the program.
Carl. Hello.
Hey, Carl. You're on the air. What's up?
My name's Carl, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey,
I called to speak something about the what's going on in the election in the country, and the opposite word is change. However, there's not as much change as people seem to think there is. And your experience with the racial comments about Obama are an example of that. Continuation of the prejudicial experience suffered by African Americans.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, there is the more covert discrimination against African Americans and against women in terms of what the media has been doing in this whole election process. Talking about Iowa and New Hampshire, the voters are described with the glowing terms of being knowledgeable, involved, experienced, committed, all those kinds of things. And yet, when they turn to South Carolina, the only thing they say is majority of the South Carolina voters are black, and the whites are, those Christians.
Yeah, in other words, the media is making it all about race and divisiveness.
Absolutely. African Americans have often talked about, I would rather talk with deal with a racist than the hidden experience.
Than the subtle racism. You're absolutely right, Paul, and well said. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. I have two issues. One is this issue of experience that they say Obama doesn't have. Do they forget John Kennedy only had a couple years' experience in the
Senate? I think John Kennedy had either two or three terms in the House of Representatives, and he was in his second term in the United States Senate. So he had, plus he'd been in a war in World War II and, was blown out of the water and for several days in a row swam out into shark-infested waters to try and get help. I mean, John Kennedy had a hell of a resume and a lot of service at the federal level, and he grew up in a very political family. Now, that's not to put down Barack Obama. That's just to say that a comparison between the two,
I think,
is imperfect.
Well, the other comparison was in the Seattle editorial page. You might have seen this, a cartoon that shows older voters saying, Obama, ? How can you support a lawyer from Illinois who has only 2 years of experience on a national level? And a young voter is saying,
well, the description there is Abraham Lincoln.
And they're standing in front of Lincoln's memorial.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, if you want to draw a parallel of, inexperience from Illinois, at the federal level, Lincoln had run for the House of Representatives, as I recall, unsuccessfully. I know he lost at least one election, so good point. Thank you for making it. Greg in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Greg.
Hey there, Tom. I just have a question. How legal is it for the press to discriminate a candidate's attention, aside from others being equal, the attention that he's giving to all of them? How can they discriminate because a candidate doesn't have enough money to throw at that particular media business?
That's
a big excuse.
Yeah, there's two pieces of an answer to that question, Greg. The first is, where is that money going to end up?
Where is it going to end up? What do you mean?
I mean, if a candidate raises, $30 million, $50 million, $100 million, where is that money going to end up?
Well,
it's going to end up with the media. So it shouldn't surprise us that the media is discriminating against candidates based on how much money they have, because those candidates with the most money are going to be the biggest donors to the media, number one. Secondly, you've got a situation where down in Florida you had Jane Aker and Steve Wilson, who are actually a married couple. They were a couple of reporters for the Fox station down there. This is not Fox News. This was a Fox-owned television station. And they did a report, an investigative report, on recombinant bovine growth hormone, RBGH. And it didn't come to the best conclusions. It came to the conclusion that there might be some concerns here. They were told over 30 times to rewrite the story. I mean, they kept rewriting the story over and over and over again until finally they were being told to lie. And at that point, they said, we will not lie on the air. Because there was an advertiser, one of the companies that made RGBH, that was apparently objecting to this investigation. And the Fox station wanted Jane and Steve to lie on the air. And I think Fox RGBH suit. .com is the website for it, but it's easy enough to Google, Jane Aker, Steve Wilson. And so anyhow, they got fired for refusing to lie on the air. They sued for unfair unfair firing. This was 5-6 years ago. They sued. And, in fact, we had Jane Aker here on the program. Must have been 4 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that, when this happened. They sued, and a jury of their peers unanimously found that Fox had unfairly terminated them and should pay them a couple $100,000 in punitive damages plus back salary. Fox appealed that to an appeals court, and the appeals court ruled that Fox, as the employer, had the right to say to their news people, you must lie on the air, and if you don't lie, you're fired. And that's where it stands right now. So when you ask the question, how can the news media discriminate against and then fill in the blank with anything, or distort and fill in the blank with anything, I point you back to that case. And the fact of the matter is that we no longer have news in the United States. We haven't had news in the United States for all practical purposes since 1987, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, the largest part of which, and then Bill Clinton really put a nail in the coffin in 96 when he signed the Telecommunications Act. Those two things, the largest piece of those two things, was that news was an obligation to hold a broadcast license. You actually had to inform people. And that's why news operations usually lost money, because to do good news is an expensive and difficult process. It's also why news reporters back before that time, by and large, made middle-class salaries. They weren't movie stars. They weren't rock stars. Nowadays, you look at most of the people who are out in front of the White House with a microphone in their hands on national television, and those people are stars. Everywhere they go, they get the star treatment. The waiters and maitre d's recognize them. People recognize them on the street. They get multi-$100,000 or multi-million-dollar salaries. They are now part of that 1% of Americans who have so tremendously benefited by the Bush tax cuts on millionaires and billionaires and by the Bush economic policies. And they know which side their bread is buttered on. If they push back at all, it's the end of their career. It's the end of a huge income. So this whole process has corrupted news. We no longer have news in the United States. We have infotainment. And, that's the tragedy. Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, we got about a minute before a break. What's up?
Hi. I wanted to tie together a couple comments. Alan Raymond had brought up racism, and Carl Bernstein yesterday had said we need to look closer at Hillary's past. I think people forget that Hillary was once a Republican who supported Goldwater.
So did I. Now, yeah. I was 13. My rationale is that I was 13. I think she's 3 or 4 years older than I am. But there were a lot of people, frankly, who I think Goldwater's idealism appealed to, and it wasn't until the Vietnam War really got cranked up that a lot of people woke up out of that fog.
Yeah, but she never woke up. She went on to support McCarthy, and then in the Nixon, she was part of a huge scandal. And a small circle of people like John Doerr, who really dropped the ball, Nixon's prosecution never stuck, and it would have stuck if they had really looked deeper into the smoking gun comment, which was on the tape, that really...
Nixon's prosecution didn't stick because Jerry Ford pardoned him. I mean, that was the bottom line. Jerry Ford put just a dead end to it. And by the way, fair. There is no doubt in my mind on this show and every other political talk show that you're going to hear, that you're going to be hearing people calling from various campaigns, representing themselves as not calling from those campaigns. Who knows? Not to say that caller was, but just keep your ears and eyes open. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Stole my money, but it wasn't enough to do the things that I most love. So my mama and my papa sold all their property, 'cause they knew how much it meant to me. I loaded up the pickup and I bid them farewell. I promised I would pay back every cent. All of the money will be well spent. I'm gonna run for president. I'm gonna run, run, gonna run.
What a plan. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And just a couple of things here quickly in the news. Bush predicting he's going to have a signed peace treaty by the end of his term. Yeah, right, what we've been working on for 50 years over or more in the Middle East. George Bush can do in just a few months, you know, no problem at all. Or at least have the appearance, sort of like the surge, you know. Yeah, it worked. It worked. It was wonderful for a little while. We're learning now that Blackwater has dropped CS gas. CS gas is serious stuff. I remember when they started using CS gas, CN and CS gas during the Vietnam War protests in the late 60s, early 70s. And really, really nasty stuff. This was in May of 2005. There are very tight controls on this for the U.S. military. But apparently those controls don't apply to Blackwater. Ron Paul is going to be let into the Fox News debate in South Carolina. Apparently Fox has had a change of heart. I don't know if this means that the Republican Party is going to sponsor it again or not, but you know, he's there. He's going to be there. And Jose Rodriguez, the CIA official, the guy who said that who erased the torture tapes, the CIA torture tapes, says that his lawyers have told Congress that on January 16th, when he's supposed to testify, he will take the Fifth Amendment unless he's given immunity. Let's hope he's given immunity, because I think this thing goes way above him. And I think that's, frankly, I think that's the whole point about it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jerry in North Carolina. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Is there any way to get those parodies that you play on your show?
The music?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sue puts together links to most of them, and it's over at our website at tomhartmann.com. You'll find links to many of them. Occasionally we get things, you know, off people's CDs or whatnot, or we don't have the right to put them up, and then there's not a link to point to, but they're there.
Okay. The point of my calling, I realize that if Barack Obama was to ask for a recount on the New Hampshire, and it didn't come through, he'd probably finish. But is there any way that, or is there any chance that in the future those ballots are going to be looked at?
Yeah, you know, there was a huge redshift in New Hampshire in the, as I recall, the 88 election, the first George Bush election. And that was a flag. I mean, there's been some significant redshift in a whole bunch of states. But I frankly don't think that that's what happened here. I would be the first to tell you. In fact, I wrote some of the first articles back in 2002, 2003 about how hackable and vulnerable these machines were. One of the first people to really be out there giving a lot of profile to Bev Harris and to what was going on. I wrote the first piece about how the senator from Nebraska, Chuck Hagel, had been the former CEO of the company that became the company that became ES&S that counts most of our votes. And I add on I'm forgetting his last name now, but the guy who ran against him, who came right out and said, you know, the machines were hacked and Hagel stole the election. But I'm not seeing the evidence of that in New Hampshire. I don't see the redshift. I know Chris Matthews opened his show last night saying, you know, how come the exit polls were different? But when you drill down a little bit deeper, it turns out that apparently they weren't. So I frankly don't think that that's the issue in New Hampshire. I think that Hillary Clinton won that thing fair and square. Now, here's the point, though. There aren't in these primaries. All of us should stop using phrases like winners and losers. Hillary picked up some delegates. Barack Obama picked up some delegates. John Edwards picked up some delegates. I don't have the list right in front of me. I've got it around here someplace. But that was the case in Iowa. That was the case in New Hampshire. And there is a threshold of delegates that they're going to need, or else you're going to have a brokered convention. And there's a certain number of delegates that they're going to need in order to be the nominee, the official nominee of the party. And all three of them, in significant fashion, I mean, they're all within a couple of points of each other, a couple of delegates of each other. All three of them are moving ahead. Right now, Barack Obama's actually ahead in terms of the number of delegates he has. So I think the whole thing of winner and loser is the wrong kind of language to be applying to these primaries and caucuses. David in St. Augustine, Florida. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. You got a great show.
Thank you.
I always enjoy it. You had incredible knowledge along with a little dose of humor.
Well, thank you kindly, David.
What do you want to talk about today? Ron Paul's white supremacist connections, John Edwards versus Obama versus Hillary? Or...
You know, I honestly don't think for a moment that Ron Paul is a racist. I really don't. You know, I don't. I've seen that article. It's unattributed. A, I don't think he would be that stupid to write it if he was, and B, if you look at his voting record, you look at everything he's done over the last 30 years, as much as I am totally opposed to 99% of Ron Paul's policies, with the exception of getting out of Iraq now, I don't think that the guy's an overt racist. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Excuse me. Tom, I wanted to ask you and get your input on some of the foreign policy that we have with Pakistan and Sudan. And what I'm referring to is using extremist governments on this war on terror. You already know, Tom, you spoke about it on your show many times about the background of Musharraf.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the fact that he overthrew a democratically elected government and we're treating him like he's some kind of small-D Democrat.
Exactly. He suspended the Constitution, jailed justices, lawyers. I mean, we all know that. And then the other one was, you remember with Sudan, it was reported in the Los Angeles Times by Ken Silverstein that the Bush administration forged a close intelligence partnership with Sudan, and we remember the whole story with Darfur, one of the worst genocides. Do you think this is a dangerous game we're playing, Tom?
Yeah, I absolutely do, Patricia. You know, Charlie Wilson's War of the Movie, for all of its faults and inaccuracies, really kind of highlights, particularly at the very end, and I'm not going to give away the ending of the movie for those of you who haven't seen it, but really highlights how dangerous a game it is. But yeah, getting in bed with dictators, you know, from our support of the Shah to, you know, on the list goes, not a good thing.
The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Mark Morano is on the line with us. Mark is the communications director for the Senate Environment and Public Works GOP Committee and on the staff of Senator James Inhofe. And, Mark, you have 400 prominent scientists disputing global warming. I see your 400 and raise you 2,200 on the IPCC.
Well, thanks, Tom, for having me on. The myth of the debate is over has been shattered, or as we like to call it, our consensus busters report. This is not just 400 scientists. This is a sampling of scientists, which add up to over 400 from around the world, who recently made comments speaking out against the idea that we're facing a, quote, climate crisis.
Why didn't you get 400 climatologists? Why do you have geologists and economists? And you've got a whole bunch of people in here who've never published anything about climate science ever, much less in a peer-reviewed journal.
Oh, my God.
It seems like you're scraping the bottom of the barrel, Mark.
Have you looked at the 2,000 UN scientists? It includes anthropologists, sociologists, economists, engineers. The head of the UN is an economist and an engineer, but the AP calls them the top scientists. The New York Times has called them a climatologist. We're using the same exact standards the UN has. Our scientists, many of them are former and current UN, either lead authors, expert reviewers. This absolutely is busting the debate. Air America listeners, your program listeners, Tom, need to know that the debate is not only not settled, but it's actually going significantly the other way when you look at the peer-reviewed studies.
ExxonMobil is getting its money's worth.
Oh, please. First of all, Mark, we all know the money's on the other side.
I know it's a cheap shot. I know it's a cheap shot. I understand, Mark. All those scientists who are talking about global warming are doing it because they want to get better grants, so more money for their research grants.
If you're going to bring up that argument, be honest about it. The money is overwhelmingly on the side of people promoting climate fares. Overwhelmingly.
Really? I thought that ExxonMobil last quarter had a larger profit than any corporation in the history of the world since the Roman Empire. How can you say that the money's on the side of the Al Gore folks?
One of your favorite groups, Union of Concerned Scientists, and others have said that ExxonMobil's only given $19 million over two decades. That's Al Gore alone is going to spend $100 million per year promoting the climate crisis. ExxonMobil is a paltry non-factor when it comes to giving to any groups with scientists.
Mark, a serious question here. And please, I hope this doesn't sound like a cheap shot, but honest to God, this is a serious question. James Inhofe, for whom you work, has been quoted as saying he doesn't believe in evolution and he believes the world is 6,000 years old. Am I correct in
my recollection
of that? You know,
I've never spoken to him about evolution. I don't think, first of all, he's a politician, not a scientist, so why is that even relevant?
And well, I'm
I don't have an answer for
you. Okay, but I believe that I'm right on those things. And the reason I ask is because I'm wondering if his willingness to take this position is not unlike James Watt's position, for example, when James Watt was the Secretary of the Interior under the Reagan administration and was asked why he was selling off federal lands at pennies for the dollar to large contributors to the Reagan administration, and those lands were then essentially being raped, drilled and mined and whatnot. He said, well, Jesus is going to return soon and make all things new. Is there a religious component to this concern that we're just being all hysterical about science here?
You're talking now, first of all, a completely separate issue. It has nothing to do with the foreign...
Well, I'm talking about the motivation of your boss and the people who are affiliated with him.
I mean, Senator Inhofe...
You can speak for yourself if you'd prefer, but I
Senator Inhofe has said, citing actual scientific studies about natural climate variability, even the Arctic, about half a dozen new studies show natural factors have caused a reduction in ice, not human-caused. Senator Inhofe has said God is still up there. Absolutely. He said that from the Senate floor. But that doesn't mean anyone who believes in God or believes, you know, otherwise can't look at the science and make objective opinions. I'm not sure where you're going with this, Tom.
Well, that was it. I'm not going anywhere beyond that. I just, you know, I was wondering if there was a, you know, James Watt was pretty upfront about it, and I thought it's a question I've never asked you. You know, we've talked many times, and I was curious.
Sure.
But in all fairness,
if your listeners go to epw.senate.gov, it's an over 80,000-word report, has the 400 scientists. This is just a sampling, once again, and mostly weighted toward English-speaking scientists because, frankly, the research, you know, Chinese and Indian and a whole host of, you know, even Norwegian languages, it gets more difficult. But the other scientists are out there. This is just a sampling. And keep in mind, only 52 scientists wrote the summary for policymakers of the UN. They're the only 52 signed off on that statement that 90% of mankind, you know, mankind is responsible. All these, you know, the dire warnings that the UN issued. 52 scientists. We best it by over 8 times in this report that's just a sample. Your listeners need to know that. No one listening to your show today can claim the science is settled, the debate is over.
I'm sorry, Mark. I see your 400 and I raise you 2,300.
Where are they? What 2,300? Where are they?
The IPCC. They're out there. There is no shortage of a consensus on this. For example, you're quoting one of your guys, Egil Frisk Christensen, the director of the Danish National Space Center.
Yes.
You quote him as saying, the sun is the source of the energy that causes the motion of the atmosphere and therefore controls weather and climate. Any change in the energy from the sun received at the Earth's surface will therefore affect climate. End of sentence in your report. You didn't add that the next sentence in his statement said, there is no reason to neglect a contribution from man-made greenhouse gases.
Oh, absolutely.
But that doesn't mean, why are you picking it? Why are you having to cherry-pick people's quotes?
You've heard of Fred Singer. You've heard of it. Even the most hardened skeptic, it concedes that CO2 can contribute to some warming, but it has nothing to do with whether, A, it has any impact on temperatures overall in terms of whether a climate crisis is coming. There's so many factors.
You're quoting Duncan Wiggum as saying the Arctic ice sheet is growing and saying that, you know, this is... And rather than shrinking, which is true, you don't point out that is actually one of the predictions of the IPCC. They said, and I'm quoting from their fourth report, the Antarctic is projected to gain ice in the near term due to heavier snowfall induced by global warming.
Absolutely, but Michael Oppenheimer and actually Christian Science Monitor just came out with an article. Many scientists are puzzled by the lack of a global warming signal. New peer-reviewed studies. Yeah, the IPCC says that, but if you look at it, Antarctica is still cooling, and it's still, there's an article yesterday that scientists are puzzled.
It's not cooling. It's not cooling. It's getting more. The Antarctic. It's not cooling. It's getting more snow. There's a difference.
It's cooling from the 1950s and the ice. I think it was half. I can't remember the number now, but it's been growing. It's now at record levels since satellite measurements began, and the Arctic, as I mentioned, multiple peer-reviewed studies blaming unusual winds, blaming ocean currents, even sunnier days just brought on by high pressure, all because of natural climate currents, not man-made global warming. Greenland has cooled since the 1940s. Do your listeners know this stuff? That's all in this report. We have a series of peer-reviewed studies. This
and
debate,
you can check it all out. You can check it all out over at epw.senate.gov. We're talking with Mark Morano, who is the communications director, Senate Environment and Public Works for the GOP committee, and on the staff of Senator James Inhofe, a global warming denier.
And don't use the word denier. Even Roger Pilkey Jr., who's on your side, has denounced the use of the word denier because of its Holocaust connotation. Can't you say, you know, skeptic or some other word? Why would you say denier? That's just
well,
not,
because you're denying it's happening.
Form.
You're denying it's happening.
No,
it's denied. You're not skeptical
First of all,
about it. You're denying it.
Climate change is reality. It's a question of man's influence and what's driving it and whether we face a climate crisis. So there's no denying. They may deny a climate crisis, as Al Gore says, but that use of that word is a pejorative, and, you know, you ought to reconsider it.
Okay, you were quoting Michael Oppenheimer. Michael Oppenheimer has rebutted. He's a scientist of Princeton.
Yes, one of the scientists, by the way, an
environmental
scientist on the payroll of environmental special interests. I don't hear you discrediting Michael Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer for that.
As I just said, he's a scientist at Princeton University and science advisor to environmental defense. You were just quoting him a second ago.
Yes.
On your side. And Oleg Sorokin, from your report, says, quote, even if the concentration of greenhouse gases double, man would not perceive the temperature impact.
Yes.
That's what one of the guys in your report says. Michael Oppenheimer, the guy that you were quoting a minute ago, says, wrong. Earth is well short of a doubling of CO2, yet changes are apparent not only to scientists but to the man in the street. Warmer winters, a melting Arctic, these are closely tied to the buildup of greenhouse gases.
What Michael Oppenheimer is saying is one scientist against 400 in that, but actually Michael Oppenheimer doesn't have the latest peer-reviewed studies on his side. Stephen Schwartz of Brookhaven Labs, a new study, most of the warming from CO2 has already occurred, according to that study. People have called that study the man-made global warming bite.
Well, to the extent that the oceans have absorbed the vast majority of the CO2, I am assuming you realize that the oceans are reaching saturation with CO2 that is changing the acidity of the oceans and is putting all marine life at risk.
Interesting you would mention that, Tom. There's actually now many climate promoters of climate fear now saying because of the uncertainty of the science.
Climate fear? You jump on me for saying climate denier?
Climate fear. I mean, the promoters of climate, when you have Al Gore talking about a climate crisis coming, I mean, I think that's fair.
I think it's here.
There's now a movement afoot. Because the science is so uncertain on the warming, to switch the debate over to oceans, because frankly, the peer-reviewed science and the number of scientists, they're losing on the debate about CO2.
Yeah, two-thirds of the planet is covered by oceans, and the oceans are the largest sink for carbon dioxide. Most of the carbon dioxide is being absorbed by the oceans, and now they're suggesting they can't absorb anymore. You disagree?
Absolutely, in terms of looking at the science. Talk to Robert Gegengag, University of Pennsylvania. He talks about even if we reduce the amount of CO2 we put in the atmosphere, the amount of CO2 will still come out of the oceans and soil and other places.
Yeah.
Mankind's contribution is ultimately very small.
EPW.Senate.gov, Mark Morano. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Little gossip coming from a loose lip of running my perfect day. Saying blah, 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 just a jack and their dog. Gotta let it roll, let it come back. I don't give a darn what other people think. What do you think about that?
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live coast to coast. The real mainstream of America. Francis in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Francis, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening.
Yes, Mr. Hartman, thanks for taking my call again. I just want to say one thing very briefly, like 20 seconds, and then I'll take this off the air because sometimes I get going. Because I spin my wheels a lot, I can see when other people are spinning their wheels, and you spent a lot of time on this presidential race and a lot of time on this global warming thing today. Here's the point. There's a man who has addressed both issues, war and the environment, and he does it in a long speech, and maybe it's too long to keep our attention spans, but Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech about the Vietnam War. I hope you can comment on that, and I thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Yeah, we've played clips, actually, from King's several of King's speeches about the Vietnam War. Probably one of the most famous ones, I think, was a week or so before he was assassinated. And a brilliant man. I'm sorry I don't have the audio up right now, or I'd be pleased to do it. Christian in Maryland. Hey, Christian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing, sir?
Just great, but I'll get better.
Great. This is my first time calling in. Just want to say I'm a big fan of the show. And, I just couldn't understand where we're going with this global warming debate. Let me tell you about myself.
Well, let me toss this in. The reason that I had Mark on is it wasn't gratuitous. These guys, Inhofe's office released this thing about a week and a half ago.
Right.
And it has been picked up by the media. I mean, it's all over the place. These guys are out there putting this stuff out. It's like they're the Energizer buddies. They're not going away. And I just felt somebody needed to challenge them.
Oh, and I appreciate you doing that. What I'd like to suggest that we do as far as challenging is concerned, though, is that, you know, just to let you know about myself, I have a degree in astrophysics. Okay, so I come from a science background. You know that astrophysicists were still debating the nature of gravity, and we're still trying to understand the nature of light.
We're still debating what electricity is.
No one denies.
We're not sure how aspirin works.
Right, exactly. Right, so here's what we need to do. the fact is that the science is definitely going to be, there's going to be some debate in the scientific community on the nature of global warming.
Sure.
That's a given.
Sure.
We're all great with that. The question then is, what do we do as citizens and governments and democracies around the world? Do we take action on it? Do we take action against it? If we take action on it, what's the worst possible thing that can happen? I would suggest that we spend a bunch of money. Okay, we spend a bunch of money. And maybe
well, not just we spend a bunch of money, Christian, if I may interrupt you.
No,
we spend a bunch of money and we end up no longer being dependent on Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabists for our oil.
How terrible, right, exactly. How bad would that be? So we're spending money and we lose some contracts, exactly. What if we don't take action? Then we know what the worst possible thing that could happen there is. You've got, right. You know, famine and hunger and you've got wars for water, not oil, for water. We got to really put the debate, in other words, what I'm saying is whenever they come after us with this argument that, well, the science isn't in, we can't make any determination about it, we need to come back and say, okay, I'll tell you what, you want to drive your car, why are you buying car insurance? You know what I mean?
Right.
It's the exact same question.
Well, Mark Morano's answer would be because the socialist government requires car insurance. But I've got your point, Christian. You know, why do you have life insurance? Why do we have health insurance? Any of it? And absolutely, you know, there is benefit. And he and I have had that conversation in the past. I said, you know, Mark, what if there's an even 5% chance that you're wrong? Aren't you concerned about your children and grandchildren? And he's like, I'm just certain I'm not wrong. And I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth. He's not here to defend himself. But I think that Mark... there are some guys, I've had people on this program who are just plain old flat out shills.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a sense of who is and who isn't. And I believe that Mark really believes this stuff. I don't think he's doing it because his paycheck is dependent on it. I think he's a person of some, you know, a reasonable amount of integrity. And I don't know if that's true of Mr. Inhofe or not, his employer. And I certainly don't know if that's true of the people who are feeding Mark the information that he's using. But, you know, I think that we have to give him that benefit of the doubt. But you're right. Looking at it in the context of the larger picture of the risk-benefit analysis, absolutely where we should be. Christian, thank you very much for the comments and for the call. Edward in New York City. Hey, Edward.
Howdy. You got to stop giving so much airplay to these global warming Goebbels. They just shout out the falses and the falsehoods. And
well, it's not like he's on every 5 minutes. I think it's been a month and a half since the last time we've had this conversation.
Well, yeah, you're right. It has been a while, but I'm really disheartened to hear that. He's getting news play.
Well, that's the point. I mean, they're all over the mainstream media, the corporate media, with this report. I mean, that's how I first learned about it, as I read about it. I think it was in USA Today I first read about it. I thought, oh, no, here
okay.
We go again.
As child as it sounds, you got to stand up there and you got to say, liar, liar, pants on fire.
There you go. Okay. Well said, Edward. Jeff in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, thanks. Something I need to get from the global warming, whatever, skeptics, deniers, et cetera. The first inkling that I think NASA had about the whole greenhouse, not NASA, scientists had about the whole greenhouse effect came from a very simple physics model of heat in the Earth. And here's the simple bit that they've got to explain. We know how much energy comes into the Earth from the sun, and that's what causes all the heat that we possess. But when the only way heat can be escaped is through infrared photons leaving the Earth's atmosphere, we know CO2 slows that down. If that slows down, how can the Earth not get hotter?
Yeah, well, good point. I mean, that's what all these scientists are saying. And they're saying, well, no, it's water vapor. Well, yeah, of course it's water vapor, because you have more water vapor being held in a warmer atmosphere. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
664-3-2270. 34 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Duffy in Oakland, California. Hey, Duffy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for all you do, man. You are just one of the best voices, and I keep telling all my friends, this guy, Tom Hartman, has got the best historical perspective of anybody I've ever heard on the radio. I've been listening for 25 years to talk radio, and I always listen to you as much as I can. But
well, thank you.
Point, Tom, is, you know, whenever a negative ad comes on that's trying to sell me fear, whether it's General Motors trying to sell me OnStar with the supposed crash of a car, and OnStar is calling the people, or whether it's even one of your sponsors. I'm sorry to say it, but the guys that are trying to sell the theft, the IB theft.
Mm-hmm.
It just turns me off so much. I turned the sound down and I pound the steering wheel. I go, God, they're selling fear again. They're selling fear. And it just, you know, that's why I believe the Democrats are going to win, because we're selling hope and we're selling a positive outlook for the future.
Yeah, I think that's one of the dimensions. It's certainly one of the dimensions of the Barack Obama campaign. And I wish that, and frankly, I think that Hillary Clinton is picking up more and more of that. And John Edwards has been, in a way, but his campaign has also been, you know, the two Americas and, hey, we've got a problem kind of thing. And I'd like to see a little more Shining City on the Hill out of the Edwards campaign, because I think all of them really should be, like you say, they should be promoting a very, very positive message. Good point, Duffy. Thank you very much for your kind comments, too. Joy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Joy, what's up?
Hi.
Or Jay, I'm sorry.
Yes. First of all, I wanted to congratulate you on a great show. My comment is with regard to the conversation earlier about global warming. I recently had a conversation with someone who sort of buys into the whole the Inhofe stuff. And the thing that I said to him was, look up the word conservative in the dictionary. The conservative response, even if there's an issue about the science, is that we would stop putting more CO2, man-made CO2 into the air. That there's an inherent contradiction. And I think this is what we should be telling them over and over again.
Yeah, when you think about it, really, you know, dumping enormous amounts of a chemical into the atmosphere that hasn't been in that atmosphere for a long, long time is kind of in and of itself a pretty radical thing.
Yeah,
and
these people are not conservative.
Yeah, it's...
And that's basically what I wanted to say. I think that that's, for example, the individual that I said this to really didn't know what to say to me.
Yeah.
Because they're following a prescription that's being sold to them by people who are, you know, who are just really out there. And
yeah.
And I think saying that to them, pointing this out, really sort of shakes them up a little bit.
Yeah, how more radical can you get than turning our atmosphere into a combination sewer and experiment?
Right.
Excellent point, Jay. Thank you. I'm sorry, Jay. I quick finger there. But good point and well said. Sanchez in Montebello, California. Hey, Sanchez.
Good morning, Tom. I hope you got enough sleep yesterday.
Almost. I think I pulled about 7 hours last night. It was nice.
You almost sounded like a beatnik yesterday. It was very, very cool.
Really? Yesterday, well, oddly enough, yesterday, and I think it was Friday, whatever day it was that I congratulated, Yeah, there you go. The two guys who got out of the race for getting out of the race, Chris Dodd and Joe Biden for getting out of the race. What was in my head was saying, you know, good on you guys for having gotten in there in the first place. I mean, you know, it takes so much courage to fight, and it's like, that was another. I've got to stop trying to do a show on 3 hours sleep. It just doesn't.
I've
got to start sleeping more. There you go.
For those reasons. Next time, try reading some Allen Ginsberg over the air. That would probably make it more authentic.
Yeah, but Howell would work, wouldn't it?
Yeah, sure would.
I've seen the greatest minds of my generation. Okay, anyway.
Okay, let me underscore something that your previous guest, Alan Raymond, was saying. But I need to, before I do that, could I ask you very quickly, this guy in the bar, your airport drinking buddy, were you able to determine, was this guy like a right-winger or just plainly uninformed?
He was a guy who voted for Bill Clinton.
Wow.
I mean, he was your classic independent voter. He voted for Ronald Reagan and he voted for Bill Clinton. And he thought that Jimmy Carter was one of our very best presidents in retrospect. You know, Jimmy Carter's the only guy who didn't get rich. I mean, we had a pretty long conversation. He'd sit there, you know,
and
he went through a couple of beers and I went through a glass of wine while we were all waiting for, you know, flights that were delayed for 3 hours.
Correct.
And this guy was your absolutely generic blue collar middle class American middle of the road undecided independent voter, and I'd say half of the other guys who were sitting at the bar with me, and about half of them were kind of, you know, blue-collar guys, and then there were, as I said, a couple of suits there.
Yeah.
And two of the suits were, you know, very clearly partisan Republicans, and one of them was very clearly a partisan Democrat.
Okay.
And I it wouldn't surprise me if they were more involved in politics, because they, frankly, didn't jump into the conversation so much.
Wow. Okay.
But anyway.
Okay, well, look, the thing that I wanted to underscore that Alan Raymond was saying was the comment that he said right at the end of his interview, can our presidential candidates, can our presidents endure a presumed attack? I cannot underscore this enough, because, first of all, let me identify myself. I'm a Kucinich supporter, and unless they slip truth and enlightenment vitamins into the American water supply, I know Kucinich isn't going to get in. But to endure another Kerry campaign where the only thing that he's giving us are inspirational speeches, it's all fine, dandy, and swell, but people like your airport drinking buddy, people like my friends in the Midwest, they perceive this as an inability to handle leadership, the inability to respond. So my suggestion for Barack Obama is to open up his speeches by completely debunking this lie, because otherwise it's going to overtake everything else that the man is trying to say. Yes, 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 shining city on the hill, that's all fine, dandy, and swell. For people that could be swayed by the shedding of a tear, that's all fine and dandy and swell. But for the people in the Midwest that perceive leadership as the main issue as to why we need a president that can handle things, he must address something like that. Because otherwise, there you go.
Yeah, Sanchez, I think you're spot on, and I think it's well said. And frankly, I think the problem is that because it's not happening in a television ad, because it's happening under the radar, just like the push polls did against John McCain back in 2000, when the Bush campaign, the George W. Bush campaign, and the PR firm associated with him, was calling up people and saying, you know, did you know that he had psychiatric treatment for his being a prisoner of war? Did you know that he had an out-of-wedlock black baby? You know, all lies, but pretending themselves to be a polling organization, because that was happening under the radar. McCain didn't take it on in public. And he didn't want it to, and he thought not to, you don't take it on in public because that gives it a whole new life of its own. And that is a conundrum. You know, if Barack Obama starts denying things, people go around, oh, why is he denying it? You know, it's like Tom Cruise coming out and saying, I'm not gay. And all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, I didn't know Tom Cruise was gay. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, to use a lousy example, you know, going back to the old episode of South Park. But anyhow, 866-303-2270, Dorothy and Raymond Washington. Hey, Dorothy.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Oh, I just wanted to compliment you on speaking back to Mark Moreno. I wanted to tell you that my daughter was went to Nairobi to speak on a panel at the UN climate conference there in 2006. And this Mark Moreno was sent down by Inhofe, and asked to be on the panel the night before, and when he got on, he verbally attacked the chairman, you know, Dr. Parshari, that what his name is?
Yeah.
And they had quite an exchange.
Yeah.
But she said she and the rest of the panel...
Yeah, Mark can be combative, as you've noticed when he comes on this program.
Did that. Another thing about global warming, Amy had a fellow on that had counted all the questions that had been given to the candidates by the main debate people that are running the debate. Of 275 questions, three were on climate.
Right. Yeah, it is. Here's a topic.
They don't want to talk about it.
No, you're absolutely right. And the Republicans don't want to talk about it because they have nothing to say. And a lot of the Democrats don't want to talk about it because they're afraid that what they do say is going to get spun as, you know, tax increases or it's meddling with the economy or whatever. But, you know, thank you for your call. By the way, I mentioned earlier the number that there are not winners and losers. Contrary to what the corporate media will tell you, because they want horse races, they want the hysteria, because it draws eyeballs, it gets people all excited, which makes advertising far more profitable, particularly for television. There aren't winners or losers. There is the accumulation of delegates, And right now, as of this moment, Barack Obama has 25 delegates to the Democratic National Convention, to the, you know, ultimately the convention. Hillary Clinton has 24. John Edwards has 18. That's where it stands. And nobody else has any. And Bill Richardson dropped out of the race today, by the way. I had an opportunity to spend some time with Bill Richardson day before yesterday. What a nice guy. What a genuine guy. I sat right next to him, and he kept poking my arm. You know, he's so physical. I mean, in a friendly way, you know, like two guys in a bar kind of thing. What a decent guy. But he's out of the race. We'll see what happens in the vice presidential end. 45 minutes past the hour.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
On the telephone with Tony Blair, we was looking for intelligence that he would share. I need some information that they can't rebuke. He said Saddam was buying stuff to build a nuke. Well, let's roll. Everybody, let's roll. If I'm gonna play the game and score, well, then I have to launch another war. Well, making lots of money is a lot of fun. We make it by creating wars that can't be won. We'll blame it on Al-Qaeda nearly every day, but we'll never tell the sheep, oh, it's the CIA. Well, let's roll. Let's roll.
Yeah. Welcome back.
And now I have to build another war.
9.5 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And, of course, brought to you by your local sponsors as well as our national sponsors. If you like the show, let them know. Let them know. Let your advertisers know that you're listening. Let our advertisers know that you're listening, particularly those that, you know, ring a bell for you, those that you say, hey, you know, I like that. You know, it's even if I'm not going to buy a new car this week, I'm going to let that dealer know that when the time comes, I will, or I'll recommend him, or whatever. I mean, there's a whole lot of ways to say advertise on this program and or on this radio station, and to support the radio station that you're listening to. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Venetia, California, right? Or is it?
Yes, Venetia.
Yeah. Venetia, thank you.
Tom, there's so many things I've been listening to. A couple of items. One, first one, do you realize if McCain isn't elected president, there will never likely be a Vietnam veteran ever elected as president? Since the, well, no. We'll ever be. To hold office, we had two elected, but didn't get to serve. As a
how many World War II vets did we have? We had John Kennedy, who was a World War II vet, and Dwight Eisenhower.
We had Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Bush Sr.
Bush Sr. That's right. Yeah, Nixon had served in the military, but he was not. He did not. He did not see combat.
Yeah. So I just thought I'd point that out. I do not support Tom McCain, even though I am a Vietnam veteran, but I certainly supported Al Gore, who I wish would still run in the end. Talking about global warming, I was in environmental research and restoration for 30 years, and I can tell you with absolute, there is absolute bulletproof data, scientific data, that says that carbon, the 30% increase in carbon in our atmosphere is from oil taken out of the ground.
Yeah. And
burned as a gas, converted to gas.
And coal.
Bulletproof science.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you, Steve. You're spot on, and thank you for the call and for making both points. Morgan in Missouri. Hey, Morgan, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I would like to just tell you right up front, I'm a John Edwards supporter. I went up to Iowa and volunteered for him during the caucus, but I was wondering if you've heard any updates on those electability polls that came out a month or so ago showing that Edwards handily defeated all the likely Republican nominees.
Yeah, in the earliest poll, and I think it was a CNN poll, it might have been a Rasmussen, Edwards was the guy who most handily beat all of the Republicans. There was a more recent one done by CNN that showed that Edwards, Hillary Clinton, or Barack Obama would beat any Republican. I think we take any of that stuff seriously at our own peril. We're so far out. I mean, we're almost a year out here from the election.
Right. Well, I just was thinking about it more and more, and it reminded me that Barack Obama's big election that got him to where he is today was against Alan Keyes.
Right, a guy who didn't, the original carpetbagger. He didn't even really leave Maryland. It was a joke.
Yeah, you could run a fire hydrant against Alan Keyes and prevail.
But that, I don't think that we should use that to diminish Barack Obama. I mean, that was just the reality of that race.
It
could be. In fact, you could argue that demonstrates the strength of Barack Obama, that the Republicans didn't even bother to put up a real candidate against him because they knew they'd lose.
Well, the whole Illinois Republican Party was in shambles due to sex scandals and divorces and everything at the time, the Family Values Party, But I just wanted to bring that up. I think it's a real sad turn of events that Edwards is getting almost zero coverage in the press, but I appreciate the fact that you reminding people of the delegate account as things go on, and hopefully
he's still very much in the race. I mean, as you point out, and thank you very much for the call. As you point out, the Bill Richardson zero, Kucinich zero, Gravel zero, Chris Dodd zero, Joe Biden zero, John Edwards 18 delegates, Hillary Clinton 24 delegates, Barack Obama 25 delegates. That's where it stands right now. We don't have winners and losers. We have three people who are serious contenders for the presidency. And in terms of delegate counts, anyway, and perhaps more as time goes on. Time will tell. Jenna, and is it Jenna or Gina in Seattle?
Jenna.
Jenna. Hey, Jenna. Welcome to
the show. Hi. Thank you. I wanted to comment on Hillary, and I'm staying neutral. I decided I'm going to caucus for Kucinich, but I do have to say the recent ganging up on her has caused my knee-jerk reaction as a woman to come out, and I wanted to challenge two main memes that I find are coming out from the Edwards and Obama side of the campaign. And one is that Hillary represents the status quo, and the other one is that Obama and Edwards are status of change. And what I'd like to point out for Obama especially is that what I don't understand is if he is going to be able to build bridges and transform politics. Well, he's currently a federal senator right now for 3 years, and the Senate has, in fact, disintegrated into lower ratings than Bush and hasn't really...
Well, you could say the same is true of Hillary Clinton.
She's not presenting herself as someone who can transform politics on that inspirational level.
I think she's trying to. And she may well be, by the way. She may well be able to.
I think she is, but I'm just saying that I don't see the evidence. It's not self-evident that Obama can do what he's saying.
So, in other words, it's more claim than substance. Jenna, I've got to move along, but I wrap up this hour, but thank you for the call. My wife, Louise, her comment was she thought that the big moment for Hillary came in New Hampshire when she turned up the lights on the guy who was yelling, "Iron my shirt, Hillary." Interesting. 57 minutes after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I am looking at the most bizarre thing, and a tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room who pointed this out to me, that over at CNN, where they have the scorecard of how many delegates each person has, they have the Iowa caucuses, Obama 16, and New Hampshire primary, Clinton 9. You have to, dig down into, no mention of John Edwards having delegates at all. The reality is that the total delegates, 25 for Barack Obama, 24 for Hillary Clinton, 18 for John Edwards, and 0 for everybody else. It is so confusing, and it really makes it look like a two-person race. I'm boggled by it. Anyhow, Mr. Trends Research, as in trendsresearch.com, Gerald Celente on the line with us, the founder of the Trends Research Institute in 1980, author of the national bestseller Trends 2000, Trend Tracking, Far Better Than Mega Trends. Says Time, and the highly acclaimed What Zizzy Gave Honey Boy, A True Story of Love, Wisdom, and the Soul of America. Gerald, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. What are the big trends? I mean, you've been publishing this newsletter for a couple of decades now at trendsresearch.com, and you have a quite a reasonable track record. What do you see as the big trends for the 2008 this year coming up?
The panic of 08. We're in a financial crisis, and I, you know, you're talking about CNN. You know the way they're reporting. Every news channel you go to, every business channel, they're still discussing the possibility of recession.
Right.
We're in recession now. You know, when you look at the data from the Wall Street Journal, 1% of the population taking in 22.2% of the wealth, and 50% of the population, 150 million people, taking in a grand total of 12.8. We're in recession. Back here in the Northeast, I'm up in Rhinebeck, New York. I just paid $3.40 a gallon for heating oil. And I have two places I have to heat up. You know, it's 500 gallons. We're in a recession. We're going to see the worst economic times probably any living American has ever seen. This is going to be worse than the Great Depression in a lot of ways. And people aren't
in what ways?
Well, the ways are that we're starting off in a much larger deficit. Back then, it was a nation of immigrants. Anybody old enough that has, I'm 61, my parents, may they rest in peace, got married in 1934, Italian immigrants. You take a look at that photo, and everybody else has a photo like it, how dignified and respectful these people look. They weren't buried in debt to the tune of $1 trillion in credit cards, $9 trillion national deficit, a war going on that's bleeding the treasury, on and on and on. We're in conditions like no one else has ever seen before.
Well, actually, I'd say we're in conditions sort of like Germany saw after World War One.
Well, you know from the Trends Journal that we send out, we've been talking about gold prices rising since 2002, and we picked the bottom. We're looking at gold to go well over probably around 2000 an ounce, because adjusted for inflation at where it is today in the 880s, it should be around 2000 an ounce, and there's no saving the dollar. The people on Wall Street are yelling, lower interest rates, lower interest rates. Yeah, lower interest rates crash the dollar.
Yeah.
Keep them where they are, crash the economy.
Well, the federal government stopped publishing M3, the rate at which they're increasing the money supply. Back in, what, March of last year, was it?
Yeah.
They're
printing stuff up.
It seems, the numbers that I'm looking at, it sure looks to me, I subscribe to a couple of different newsletters, and, you know, I think I'm fairly well read on these things. I read the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal every morning, and not to mention all the various blogs and websites and whatnot. And in the last year, we had inflation that was somewhere between 20 and 30%.
Oh, absolutely.
For the average person. I mean, actual inflation of 20 to 30%.
Listen, what's going on, this is criminal. The federal government does not include food and fuel into the core inflation rate. And they grab out some, you know, some professor, you know, from somewhere giving you this obscure formula as to why every time you fill up your car or feed yourself and your family and the prices are going up, it's not inflationary.
Right.
Oil prices went up. They're up to, year to date, they're about 60% over last year.
Yeah, and
food prices are over 25.
Yeah. So we're looking at, you know, real inflation of 20 or 30% like that for the average person.
And the dollar isn't worth a dime anymore. Look what's going on. I love the term sovereign wealth funds buying America's biggest bank, the world's biggest brokerage.
Yeah, these are countries that are buying us.
Yeah, the countries. They got these names. You know, another great term I like. They have write-offs and write-downs. How about losses? You know, can they use that word?
Yeah.
We're going to see an economic 9/11. Right now they're blaming everything on the subprime, the little people going over their heads. How about these groups, Blackstone Group, Carlyle, the other one that bought Cerebus, they make these names up like drug companies, that bought out Chrysler. They bought them down with no money down. And now with the credit crunch, you're going to see huge, huge crashes coming. And not only in the financials, which are the jewel of the so-called service economy, but you're also going to see major firms crash because their whole business model is built on growth and expansion, and they can't build any more stores, and they're losing customers. Current events form future trends. Look at today's retail sales.
Right. We've been playing Monopoly, and the game is over.
The game has long been over. And by the way, don't blame this on Bush. This goes on a long time. It goes back from Nixon, and everybody kept it going. And boy, did Clinton do his share. They put the last nail in the Glass-Steagall Act that had prohibited the banks from running amok as they are now.
Yeah, that and Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act and WTO and NAFTA. I mean, those were absolutely unforgivable in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, look, Bush had won and Reagan couldn't push through NAFTA or the Glass-Steagall Act. It took this... Look, people, I'm Italian-American. I've heard enough mafia stories for the rest of my life. If you want to look at the mafia, you could call them the Republicans and the Democrats. And if you want to look at who's running the families, you could call them the Bushes and the Clintons. 20 years, and if the polls are right, 24.
Yeah, and then comes Jeb.
Here comes Chelsea.
Who knows?
Doing the Buddha bow. I love that one.
Yeah, we're talking with Gerald Celente. He publishes a newsletter. You can get it over trendsresearch.com, the Trends Research Institute. Gerald, what should my listeners be doing to get ready for this tsunami?
First of all, start cutting.
Actually, two quick questions. Number one, what should they do to get ready? And number two, will the administration be able to keep their finger in the dike long enough that they can push this thing back 12, 13 months and they can blame it on the Democrats?
First of all, what to do? Understand what gold is doing. And we're not giving financial advice. We only forecast trends. If you have kids, think of taking them out of college unless they're going to get out with a return on their investment. There's the military-industrial complex and the college-industrial complex. Cut back on spending. Don't buy anything that you don't need. What other country has storage units to put your extra junk in? The other thing is conservation engineers. It's not an environmental movement. It's a smart movement. Any businesses that teach you how to save and get more from what you have, big businesses. As for the federal government, this is out of anybody's control. And if you think that they have the power to do anything, look what they did with Katrina, and look at the great job they're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, I would argue that those are the triumphs of ideology over practical reality. You know, the Bushies wanted to prove the government didn't work, and so they broke it.
This is out of control. Out of control.
Yeah, yeah. So get out of debt, downsize your life, downscale your life. What about employment? What about jobs?
That's what I'm saying. Anything having to do with conservation, energy efficiency, micro farms, buy local. There's going to be a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities. When the big giants fall, they're going to leave a lot of niches. You're even seeing it already with Starbucks. Their model can't survive in this kind of economy. And when anyone does anything, I say this everywhere I go, don't let your quality down. High quality and a point of difference in everything that you're doing, and that's where you're going to make money. Life is not going to come to an end, but you have to go to the markets that are smart. And heal yourself out of healthcare. I mean, your audience, I don't have to tell them this. I mean, they already know. But, I mean, anybody that buys prescription drugs has to be out of their mind after they listen to the disclaimers that are longer than the commercials.
Right, yeah. Get healthy, stay healthy, use natural medicines, things like that.
Herbal tinctures, the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And yesterday, one of the newsletters that I get said, okay, it's time now officially to get out of the stock market with the exception of energy stocks, oil stocks, and the few commodity stocks that are out there. Pretty much everything else is going to go in the tank. You think
well,
so?
Well, the stock market, look what the value of it is now. The NASDAQ is less than half the value it was when it peaked in 2000. You know, it's a rigged game. Listen to Cramer. He even said it on a webcast.
Yeah. Yeah, even the Republicans are saying it now. So, there you go. Gerald Celente, trendsresearch.com. Gerald, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Just like every other morning before, now I wonder what my life is going to be if it's gone. The cars are moving like a half a mile an hour, and I started staring at the passengers and waving goodbye. Can you tell me what was ever really special about me all this time?
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Sherry in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Sherry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to thank you for cracking the code. It changed the way I speak and it changed the way I listen. I think it's amazing.
Thank you.
My mother-in-law, who's a lifelong Republican, mentioned to me a while back she wanted to change her party affiliation. I was really surprised. I said, that's great. Why? And she says, well, this Barack Obama, you know, he was raised, you know, schooled in a madrasa, the whole repeated. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. She was going to change her party affiliation.
From Democratic to Republican?
Yeah, so she wanted to become a Democrat so she could try to vote in our primary so she could try to prevent his victory.
To vote against Obama.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm telling you, that email has gone so viral, and if his campaign doesn't do something about it, I'm really concerned. I mean, he's being swift-voted, and I'm not sure he even knows it.
Yeah, I don't know if he appreciates it, but I've heard it now from a couple of people. I immediately dispel it, but I really don't think he maybe doesn't appreciate how big it is out there, and people are willing to vote against him, against their own party, just to vote against him based on this false fear.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Sherry, thanks a lot for the heads up on that. Kendra in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Kendra.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. That's so sad about that email. I got a really ugly one about Hillary lately, too. But, Tom, I was wondering, do you know where Barack stands on No Child Left Behind?
I don't. I don't have a list of the issues in front of me right now. I'm sorry.
That's cool.
I know broadly right across the board, all of the Democratic candidates are calling for either doing away with No Child Left Behind or majorly reforming it.
Perfect.
A program that, if it was actually well-funded, has actually arguably some good pieces to it, but, you know, at least half of it needs to be just chopped off and dropped into the sea.
Okay, that's cool. I'm glad to hear that. Boy, we have had the nicest, the best, brightest group of Democrats. I just am impressed with every single one of them. Anyway, I don't have a thing to say, so go on to your next call.
Okay, thanks a lot, Kendra. I appreciate the call. George in Conoco Park, California.
You know what bothers me is that how did in this case where the Fox News reporters were, where their case was overturned, well, I don't understand why the attorneys didn't bring out the issue that when you're presenting news, it's supposed to be accurate.
But it's not. I mean, that was what the appeals court ruled, was that news does not have to be factual.
Well, the word news means it implies factual.
Mm,
so I don't know how they could stretch it.
And there was a time in America when news actually meant news, although I would say going back to the founding of this country, news has been somewhat skewed. Here's the big issue, George, and thank you for raising that. It used to be that we knew the bias of the suppliers of our news. I mean, again, going back to the founding of this country, there were Federalist newspapers, which today would be the Republican Party, and there were Democratic Republican, often referred to as Republican newspapers, which is today's modern-day Democratic Party newspapers. And, in fact, John Adams, the second president of the United States, our first conservative president of the United States, put 20 of the publishers and editors of the what would today be called Democratic newspapers in prison to shut them up with the Alien Sedition Acts. But nonetheless, when you read a newspaper, you knew its bias. And that was the case right up into the 1970s. You know, most towns had two or three newspapers, and you knew that this newspaper was going to have a heavy bias toward labor or a heavy bias toward business. They were going to editorialize about it. They were going to report on it. They would have a labor section. We used to have newspapers in the United States that had labor sections. What a mind-boggling concept. For 100 years, we had newspapers across the United States that had labor sections and other newspapers that had business sections. And what happened when Reagan saw in 1981, 1982, in the early 1980s, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which forbid the cancer stage of capitalism, the end stage, the monopoly stage, where everything gets bought up by basically a small number of companies, and you have monopolies. When Reagan stopped enforcing that law, two things happened. The first was a whole bunch of people got really rich just throwing companies together and throwing people out of work. You get two or three companies that are all doing the same thing, that were competing with each other. You get them all bought by one company. And number one, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in the transaction. Wall Street was doing well. Number two, now you've got three companies doing something that, or one company doing something that three companies used to do. So you can lay off all the, you know, now you only need one bookkeeper, not three. Now you only need one, you know, advertising department, not three. And so a lot of jobs got lost. These things hurt the economy. They hurt the average working person. They helped the top 1%. And along with that, we lost news, because that aggregation that occurred didn't just occur in all the various, you know, industries, manufacturing industries and clothing industries and all this kind of, it happened in the news industry as well. And so in the news industry, you ended up with a single paper's, you know, most towns now have one newspaper, and they pretend that they're unbiased, but they're not. They're really biased towards corporations.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome to a satellite. 20,000 miles up in the sky each night. Yeah, we're living in a modern world.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I'm very pleased to have with us today, as we very often do on Thursdays, Christy Harvey, one of my favorite people. She is the Director for Strategic Communications, only strategic communications, at the Center for American, or especially strategic communications, at the Center for American Progress. She also does the daily news prep site, miccheckradio.org. AmericanProgress.org is the Center for American Progress's site, and thinkprogress.org, their blog. Christy, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
I am great, but I'll
good here.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you so
great
much. It's kind of a dreary and grouchy day here in Washington, so this is brightening things up a lot.
Yeah, well, speaking of brightening things up, apparently the FBI is not going to be wiretapping because of unpaid bills. What's this?
Well, the good news, if you're a criminal, that is that the FBI has accidentally compromised a lot of their legal warranted wiretap investigations. But yeah, it turns out that the Inspector General, Glenn Fine, took a look into the FBI finances, and the FBI just stopped paying their phone bills. And so all of these telecom companies cut off their surveillance investigations and cut off their wiretaps, because they had one agency in particular had a $66,000 phone bill they had not yet paid. And the bad news is they lost tons and tons of evidence, because they either had their wiretaps seized, or they weren't able to access them, or they weren't able to continue them. You know, if you've seen the show The Wire, you know what a big process these wiretaps can be. And yeah, they just didn't pay their bills.
Why?
Nobody really knows.
Really?
They're saying that it's actually a horrible lack of oversight.
Well, the FBI works for the Justice Department, and the head of the Justice Department was Alberto Gonzalez, and he was appointed by George W. Bush. And none of these guys believe the government can work or should work, and so it looks like they have created a self-fulfilling prophecy here.
Well, right, and we knew that they weren't very effective, and we knew that it was a pretty incompetent bunch of people over there. But honestly, I thought that the FBI would be at least a step up from my deadbeat roommate. You know what I mean? The FBI is supposed to just at least make sure that the phone stay on.
I hope your roommate's not listening. altering reports on global warming, refusing to work with International Energy Code. We had Mark Morano on the program earlier, the
uh-huh.
James Inhofe's guy, and he comes on every couple of months, every time he's got some new report that he can get on CNN or whatever about how there ain't no such thing as global warming, or at least the human hand in it. This year's presidential budget is going to be paperless.
Every once in a while, I can actually watch something on C-SPAN and feel my spinal cord start to melt with anger. But, yeah, they announced yesterday, the White House announced that due to their deep concern about the environment, they were going to go to a paperless budget this year because, and Jim Nussle actually said, it will save 480 trees.
Wow.
Now, I'm all for saving 480 trees, don't get me wrong. But what Jim Nussel forgot to say was, you know, how they've been trying to cut down all the forests out west and how they've been trying to change the laws in 60 million acres of national parks to allow snowmobiling and logging there. So forget those millions of trees. They want to save these 480 trees, and they want us to know that they care deeply about
Why?
The environment.
Why do they want to do this?
A, I think that, I mean, you can save money by going paperless. So I think that they said, you know what, this is an easy, easy, easy thing for us to do. And, you know, we can get a little bit, maybe there's someone out there who does not know that we are the devil when it comes to the environment and will actually buy that we're trying to be green. But also, I mean, down here in Washington, you know, it's we're dorky and it's a big deal when budget day comes and you get these gigantic, huge tomes, and you page through them, and it's really difficult, and the language is very tough, and it's really difficult to page through these things. I think it's going to be impossible to have to do it completely online. I just think it's going to make it a lot harder to get through the budget. So it's a twofer for them. They can save a little money, and they can make it harder for people to know what's in their budget.
Yeah. I'm seeing at the very top of Think Progress here, the Pentagon is backtracking on the naval confrontation with Iran, that perhaps this whole thing was just blown out of proportion.
Exactly. And, they're starting to sort of step away from the really inflammatory language that they were using. And I think it's interesting because, you know, I wasn't around when it went down the first time, but I saw this and all I could think of was, my God, has no one out there heard of the Gulf of Tonkin?
Right.
You know, it just seemed to have this weird flavor to it. So I don't know that we're going to know in the next couple of days, weeks, or even months exactly what went down there. But I think that the Pentagon knows, especially, you know, I think that Robert Gates is not a bad guy. And I think that he may have even had a hand, I think, in saying that we don't do anybody a good service by trying to escalate things with Iran right now.
Yeah. Well, he's for all practical purposes, said that in the past about the, you know, the kind of rhetoric that has been going on around this thing. Blackwater dropping CS gas. CS gas is nasty stuff.
Nasty stuff.
And I recall when they were using it for riot control back in the 60s, and it hurts. And they used this stuff in Iraq in a way that the military couldn't. This is bizarre.
It really is. CS gas is basically tear gas. But it is, there are very, very strict restrictions in the military on when it can be used. And actually, it is technically banned by our International Convention on Chemical Weapons that we signed on to. But in 1975, we said, you know, if it is a serious and severe situation and the President of the United States or a senior officer he has designated says it's okay, only then can the military use this in a war zone. And so our military is not able to use it, but it turns out that Blackwater was trying to get through some traffic back in 2005, and they decided to drop the CS gas on a convoy to try and get some of their trucks through some serious traffic. And it burned the eyes and skin of American soldiers and of Iraqi civilians, and even worse, and it's all about, you know, what we've talked about before, Tom, where these contractors are above, under, outside the law and
beyond.
Can sort of do whatever they want over there. But it's really bad, not just because, you know, it hurt a bunch of people, but it also, they said, is playing into the propaganda that the U.S. is using chemical weapons in Iraq and really doing us a disservice for what we're trying to accomplish over there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been really no investigation.
Yeah,
they're off the hook for it.
Well, and there won't be an investigation because,
because this
administration doesn't investigate things, and B, because there doesn't seem to be any law that governs what Blackwater does in Iraq.
Well, and they asked the State Department, you know, the military can't use this. How on earth did Blackwater, A, get its hands on this stuff, and B, think that it was okay to use? And Blackwater says, well, the contract didn't specifically say we couldn't use it. Contract didn't say that they could use it.
Right.
But they said, you know, we reread the contract and it didn't specifically say you may not use banned riot gas at will to get through tough traffic. So we did.
Wow. Amazing. The Justice Department has started an internal inquiry into John Ashcroft. And a no-bid 18-month contract?
Yeah, this is some tricky stuff, and this is coming out of New Jersey. And a top federal prosecutor in New Jersey named Christopher Christie, which is a name into itself, but he used to actually work for John Ashcroft at Justice. Now he's top federal prosecutor in New Jersey, and he gave John Ashcroft an 18-month no-bid contract, free money basically, worth up to $52 million. $52 million. He's also done this to
two
other...
Not bad work if you can get it. This is for a guy who lost out to a dead guy in a senatorial election. Oh. He's really come back well.
I always think of John Ashcroft as the guy who covered up the naked statue in his press conferences. I always forget that he lost to the dead guy also.
It was in Missouri.
Well, not only did this guy, Christopher Christie, do this, but they kept it a secret. And you know when things come out and they've been kept a secret for a while, there's always something that smells off or is a little shady about the deal. So now they're looking into now why this went down and whether it was a conflict of interest or a breach of ethics or, you know, whatever you want to call it, just out-and-out corruption.
What are you seeing? We're talking with Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications for
quite a mouthful.
Indeed, for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org and ThinkProgress.org. Christy, what are the stories that you're seeing that are flying under the radar right now that you think that either A, we should be paying attention to and we're not, or B, that are going to blow up in our face in the near future?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think that we've got a taste today of all of the stuff because today, of course, is the one-year anniversary of President Bush announcing the surge. Mm-hmm. And so there has been a little bit coming out about that and about how it hasn't worked, but I really expect to see this escalate in the next couple of weeks, especially since we've been really facing a couple of deadly days over in Iraq.
Mm. Although McCain and Lieberman today declared the surge a victory.
Oh, exactly. And everything is fine and good, and McCain wants to wander around the marketplaces, even though they're always the safe ones. But, yeah, I think that this is over the next couple of weeks, as Iraq has sort of gone to the back burner with everyone so focused on the domestic crises of health care and education and of especially the economy right now, I really think this is going to start to pop back up and be something big. And I also think that we haven't seen the end of the CIA torture tapes. And, you know, it was one of those stories that was a big explosion of pow, and then that also, people get bored and started stop talking about that. But we'll see what happens with that, with the CIA official who now says he wants immunity or he's not talking.
Yeah, that could be the thing that breaks it open, because Mukasey would not appoint a special prosecutor, and a truly independent prosecutor. So, you know, maybe some big revelation will pop this thing open.
Exactly.
Christy Harvey, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Always great having you on, Christy. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
45 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Actually, it has begun. It really and truly has. 9 minutes before the hour, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us with her brand new, spiffy, incredible website over at talkradionews.com. And Victoria, it's been so long since we've talked. It is great to have you back with us.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Well, thank you, and Happy New Year to you, too. I hope you were off vacationing.
I was for a while. I went to London over Christmas, and I had a great time.
Oh, marvelous, marvelous.
Yeah,
so what's up in Washington, D.C. these days?
Well, it's quiet because the president's out of town, as you know. He's in Ramallah on the West Bank, and he's been saying today that he's going to have Middle East peace, within 12 months. He said he's on a timetable. He's got 12 months, and it's going to happen.
So he's going to have Middle East peace before he has New Orleans rebuilt.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, it may be easier to do.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Question of priorities.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well,
legacies.
Right, and legacies. And stabilizing a region so that you can protect the oil supplies and your
all
buddies can make more money on the oil, yeah.
Yes, he said in one of his more memorable lines, the choice being, and he's making the choices, laying them out for Palestinians, do you want this state or do you want the status quo? Do you want a future based upon a democratic state? And here's the memorable line, or do you want the same old stuff?
Oh, gee, what a Reagan-esque, Kennedy-esque speech.
I thought so. I thought you'd appreciate it. But he does believe that he's going to get peace by that time, but he doesn't seem to think that there's going to be very much movement with Gaza, which, of course, as you know, is controlled by Hamas.
Right.
He's not visiting there, and he doesn't have any plans to be talking to them anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why we don't just get it. You know, Hamas, to the extent that they've been having success, and obviously they have in Gaza, and Hezbollah and southern Lebanon, have, to a large extent, and for that matter, Al-Qaeda in many parts of the world, you know, in North and Northwest Africa, for example, and in parts of the Middle East, and in Western Pakistan, to the extent that they're all having success, in large part not because they're militants, not because they're crazies, not because they're running around spouting jihad talk or anything like that. They're having success because they're building hospitals, they're feeding people. They're providing the equivalent of Social Security. They're caring for widows and orphans. They're caring for disabled people. They're building schools. And you know, why don't we just look at that and say, you know, that's a hell of a lot cheaper than bombs.
Because we're not going to do that. I think we're just simply philosophically not going to do it. I think it's philosophically impossible for President Bush to make that leap.
Then we're always going to lose to them. Because you know,
I think that's going to happen.
You win the people's hearts and minds. I mean, that's how you know we rebuilt after World War II. We rebuilt Germany and Japan. The Japanese love us. The Germans love us. Why? Because we built schools. We built hospitals. We rebuilt their infrastructure. Why couldn't we have done that in Iraq? Well, yeah, I'm asking rhetorical questions, and I know that. Anyhow, what else is going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, meantime, as you know, we've got Governor Richardson about to withdraw from the race. He's having a press conference this afternoon. We don't know whether he's going to direct his followers to go in any particular direction or not. We don't know what he's going to do. I mean, he doesn't have a major number, but nevertheless, with such a tight race, any number could make a difference.
He doesn't have any delegates that he has won, but are there any superdelegates? Now, in the Democratic Party, all of the sitting Democratic governors, members of the House and Senate, former presidents, former vice presidents, Al Gore is a superdelegate, Bill Clinton, all of these, and members of the high end of the party, there's some 800 of them, I think, about 40% of the total delegate total are called superdelegates, and they're not elected, and they can pretty much go with anybody they want. And occasionally they pledge early on, although they also change. Like a lot of them pledged for Howard Dean, and then when he came in third in Iowa, they unpledged for Howard Dean. Does Bill Richardson have any superdelegates?
Don't know the answer to that question. A very interesting question, and I haven't heard anybody ask it.
Okay. My sense of it is that right now most of the superdelegates, there's a couple of people who have come out. One of the governors of one of the eastern states has come out and pledged support for Hillary Clinton. There have been a few superdelegates who have already pledged, but, you know, that's always subject to change. And so, I was just wondering, you know, what does Richardson have to throw to somebody? Because he hasn't won any delegates so far as I know.
No, he doesn't have delegates. He just has potential voters at this point.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah. Well,
that's it.
That's nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's definitely not. In terms of tight races, of course, John Kerry has endorsed Obama, as we know.
Yes. Yeah. And that's an interesting story. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, all new and improved website over there. Victoria, it's so great to have you back. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday. Bernie Sanders will not be with us. He's flying back from Africa. But we will be taking your calls on all topics. Anything you want to talk about? The radical middle here, the Tom Hartman program, the idea of the commons. Indeed. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.